You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of September 25th, 2019, and today we're spending some time on the holodeck.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alboy.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And I could not be more excited. Dear listeners, George has embarked on a continuing mission to seek out strange new worlds.
Yes, I've made a huge mistake, and I'm finding myself adrift in the galaxy.
New life, new civilizations, and terrible scripts.
Yes, I have been watching Star Trek The Next Generation from season one, the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Look, and I made a commitment.
Longtime listeners know that I am unabashed. Star Trek is kind of like one of those series where it's like your own family. Like, you can talk shit about it, but it's because you love it. And if someone else talks shit about it, you need to defend it.
Yes, that's totally. Yeah, Star Trek TNG, especially season one, is like the really dumb cousin you have, you know?
It's like, you can make fun of him, but if anyone else does, hey.
Yeah, I made a commitment that I would start from the very beginning and not skip a single episode, which, by the way, I'm hearing from left and right is a horrible idea, because there's just a lot of stinkers. And I felt like I made a huge accomplishment getting through season one, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I mean, think about all the lore that you've got. That's the thing. That's how it gets you in. Like, it sets the stage for things like Q and Data's whole mission towards humanity and the holodeck. All that shit starts
and
at season
the holodeck,
one.
Holodeck. Yep. Although there's also episodes where literally nothing matters. Everyone pretends it didn't happen as soon as it's over. Doesn't make a lick of sense.
Yeah, you know, that's just. That's why you do a deep space mission. You know, some days it's like, well, guys, that was a wash. Warp back to six.
Like, what are we going to learn? Not a whole lot. Let's go ahead and go into warp speed. Warp speed 9. Let's get the fuck out of this crazy episode.
Computer, delete all those logs.
Yeah, seriously. Okay, we're talking about the holodeck because I watched an episode about the holodeck and it raised a lot of questions about holodeck technology, why things happen, but also, it's interesting to me that the holodeck is still this sort of quintessential virtual reality space in the way that we talk about video games. So I want to talk a little bit about your experiences with the holodeck, your thoughts on whether or not it still holds up as this like ideal, and then just the way that Roddenberry and his writing team imagine we would use that technology in the future. Because, I mean, we know, look, it's also used for porn. We know that. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet.
You've definitely seen that because remember Riker's Harp Girls?
Well, yeah, that was in his room, though. I think he had like a miniature hologram thing.
Oh, you're right. That was a hologram. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I guess, does anyone walk in? Because you just can walk in the holodeck. That's the crazy thing.
Yeah, that is. Without spoiling too much, they definitely address that.
Okay, good. Ooh, man, can't wait. Man, where to start? Because honestly, there's so much. There's so much about the holodeck, right?
Like, I mean, I think one thing that I'll say just on a practical level is I feel like I feel like it's a symbiotic relationship where the holodeck helps me understand a video game world system.
Oh, interesting.
And also video games help me conceptualize how a holodeck would actually work.
That's true. Like, they talk a little bit, even in this past episode, about season 2, episode 4, by the way, or episode 3. If you're following along and you want to watch along. They talk about the way that the holodeck cheats and plays around with your vision to augment what you think is actually happening. Yeah. So they'll use forced perspective to imply depth that isn't actually there. Yep. I still don't fully understand how you can move and not bump a wall. What's that all right. about?
I mean, again,
I assume there's like a treadmill or some shit.
Well, yeah, that's what, I mean, again, I haven't read this chapter of the technical manual yet, but my understanding is that it is an elaborate series of subtly sloping people, you know, and also just using perspective tricks to figure out like how to maneuver people in a space. But to your point, it's extremely relevant when you are thinking about a video game system where, oh man, I'm Kratos and I'm climbing up this massive mountain and it looks like I can see for miles and miles around. Actually, you are in a very specific set piece rendered in Maya or whatever engine they're using. Yep. I guess Maya is dating me. Like that was probably in the 1990s or whatever, but whatever, you are in an Unreal light box that has been painted to look infinite, but it's actually very tightly scoped. And so it's like, that's what I mean by it allows me to, I feel like I understand both concepts better because each one of them adds knowledge to that of like how they do the tricks to make it all work.
I totally agree. And I would actually say it's interesting that they consistently show people in the future. This is in Star Trek, by the way.
Yeah, the 24th century.
In the 24th century. Everyone knows the holodeck is a thing. But consistently they go in it and someone comments, oh, this looks so real or there's such detail. And so I like that they're showing how, even though you're aware that it's fiction, it's so easy for the mind to just believe things are real and that you can hold those two things true simultaneously, right? Like I can be in a video game and both appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into creating this fictional world and be fully in it and immersed in the setting itself, right?
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about Control probably in like a week or two.
Yep.
And that game does some crazy shit with the way that like you're moving around the world, or there's a couple of challenges in particular that come to mind that just squish space or extend it really suddenly. That I love it when video games do that because there's no reason it has to obey the regular laws of physics. I mean, unless the game is trying to be, you know, very photorealistic, but those moments of really creating surreality, if you will, or the same sense that you get in dreams where when you're in a dream and you're moving from one location to another and you get there in a jiffy, even though you know it would take you much longer, but you still feel it. Like there's just these bizarre rules that don't apply in dream spaces that also don't apply in something like the holodeck because they can be whatever they want it to be. And it's cool to see games really exercise that.
And I will also say on the opposite side of the spectrum, in the show, people are consistently impressed by, look how real this looks, or I can smell the ocean. Like this is amazing. And people are still like that. I remember when we were playing Red Dead Redemption, we were like, what the fuck? This is amazing.
Yeah, that looks like gorgeous.
That looks like a mountain. And it's like, and so like that always, I think humans will always pursue verisimilitude as an interesting challenge. And that's just an extreme version of that. And people will always be impressed by meticulous design. And so that's also a thing that rings true when you're thinking about a video game.
Do you ever see anyone go into the holodeck and it's just a fucked up Warner Brothers cartoon world in there? Because that would be so cool. Because, I mean, think of it this way, right? Like, I love the top of the mountain. It's great. Awesome views, Kratos. But I also enjoy Cuphead.
Right. It would be funny if they went in there and it was like the Paula Abdul video with MC Scat Cat or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, Picard really likes what he likes, like noir, like SF neo noir or whatever. Yep. And Data loves Sherlock. There's got to be someone like Geordi's got to be really into fucking like Bugs Naruto. Bunny or something. Yeah, exactly, dude. Just full anime. You see fucking Geordi Naruto running through the holodeck.
That would be. I don't know if they ever get into. I don't know if they ever get into the cartoonish aspect of it. I mean that's probably so, like,
certain scenes are cartoony, let's put it
well, but to not, say nothing not of the acting. I don't think there's ever like a Roger Rabbit style moment of
you've seen that show Archer, yes,
uh-huh,
where the doctor makes like an anime wife.
Oh yeah, he has like that's Hatsune Miku or whatever.
Yes, like, that's what we need, like Hatsune Miku in the holodeck, because that is a reality that we live today that we just did not foresee in 88 or whenever this episode was shot and filmed.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, George.
Uh-oh.
There are multiple characters on TNG that legit fall in love with holograms.
That's cool. That's interesting. All right. I mean, hey, look.
You got some stuff ahead of you.
I mean, there are people who legit probably are genuinely in love with their body pillows, you know?
We're not here to judge.
We're not here to judge. All right. Another what thing do you think that
jumped, of, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say another thing that jumped out at me that I was commenting on last night is it's interesting that, at least thus far, outside of Worf, who was being weird because he's a Klingon, uh-huh. no one goes into the holodeck to really take on a explicit challenge. Like, there's no one we've seen go in there to play Call of Duty and kill people, right? Like, Worf does it as his exercise regimen. But it's interesting that thus far, the form of entertainment that people have is not simulated violence in the holodeck. And I guess, if anything, it's really to be in places or realities that they can't be, partially because they're stuck on a ship, you know? Like, it is its truest form of escapism, not the more ludic tactical challenge that I think we associate with video games.
You're right. Like, it is biased towards, I mean, it's an interesting way of addressing the whole R&R challenge of, like, what do people do in their downtime? What if they're in deep space and they don't have a planet to visit? Like, how do you let people have relaxation when they're stuck on this ship? And I think part of that, this whole conversation
you can't always
is kind
be
of
on
like
the sex planet from season one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and Risa is on the other side of the galaxy. Like, it's hard, but I think that, well, this is kind of like a snake eating its own tail type of thing. I think part of it is just the utopian vision that that suffuses that entire series supposes that people are there for intellectual or emotionally positive pursuits. And because of that, the way that we think about VR or video games often is informed by that, where it's like, okay, well, we're going to do VR, and how we need to sell this to people is it'll help you, you know, visit people that are remote from you, or it will make people more empathetic to others that they're not like, you know. That I think that the art is informing the life of how some of that stuff is actually built, even though the reality is that we're mostly all Worfs. Like, we mostly play video games to have this crazy challenge, and especially a military style challenge.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Interesting. I also enjoyed that in this latest, not in this episode, maybe it was the one preceding it, or maybe it was, it was actually a much worse episode before this one. It starts with Worf and Riker being in the holodeck together.
Yeah.
And they're both engaged. They're playing co-op, you know?
Yes, yeah.
Which is super cool. We don't generally see a whole lot of people doing that in the holodeck. Like, it implies that a lot of people will, like, reserve their time and, I don't know, have sex with weird anime people or whatever inside there and not really take on challenges together. I mean, I guess outside of some of the weird Sherlock stuff.
I think the one thing that gets more fleshed out is, and sometimes the show just doesn't address it, where there's a whole side of the holodeck that is much more banal, which is, oh, here's a bunch of training regimens, or if we're going to run a drill, a lot of time we'll do it in the holodeck because it can simulate a scenario that we couldn't simulate otherwise. And
it's educational. That stuff,
exactly. And I think even the plot of that stuff is looked at, The plot looks at that stuff as, oh, well, why would we, this is just Enterprise day-to-day life. Like, this is just logistics. Why would we devote an episode to it?
Right.
And so only get the most extreme things. But that's funny because some of the most forward-looking and also just frankly, like, invested in AR, VR experiences are industrial in nature. Like, I used to work with someone who left to go run an organization within a VR company that basically does industrial training, where people learn things, whether they're mechanics or people, this is scary, like, managers will go through VR training to simulate how to have difficult conversations with people because it's more immersive theoretically, and, like, they're able to practice their various HR lines.
Nice. You too can learn how to bust unions in VR.
Right. But I mean, that is the much more banal version of what we think of when we see all the shit at E3. But actually, there's a lot of money in that, and there's a lot of people working in that. It's just that's the workaday life that doesn't make for a hilarious or entertaining TV show slash video game.
That's true. Yeah, we missed all of the scenes where Tasha Yar is doing like weird fighting simulations.
And they reference it, though, where they're like, oh, you know, I usually do it on challenge level 7. And it's like, whoa, like, this is actually, like, quite built out. We just never talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy that being in the holodeck. I mean, think of it this way, right? Like, you've got this world-class ship, galaxy-class ship, excuse me.
Correct. Galaxy-class.
Galaxy-class. The best of the best. And there are multiple holodecks.
Yeah.
You know, and I've never gotten a sense, in the same way that Picard is weirdly sex positive, I've never gotten the sense that anyone makes fun of the frivolity of being in the holodeck.
Yeah. You know?
Like, there's even a scene where I think Wesley is just having a snowball fight, right? And mm-hmm. Picard is like weirded out because he hates kids and stuff. But yeah. For the most part, like, everyone signs up and goes on board, and they go all out, right? Like, even in this episode, Picard jumps at the chance to put on his fucking weird 19th century attire, you know, and go into Sherlock times. Like, everyone is full-on LARPing their shit in this universe, and it's not necessary, right? Like, the holodeck will react as though you're in your regular outfit.
Right.
They choose to willingly partake in role-playing that narrative, and there's no sense that the show is making fun of them for that at all. You know, it's just as normal as the industrial ends.
Yep. I mean, I think that before we were recording, we were talking about Janet Murray's Hamlet on the holodeck, which I will butcher here because I haven't read it for probably 10 years or more. But that was one of the points where she was talking about a future in which narratives are inherently more interactive.
Right.
And that's, you see that shit all the time on Star Trek. And then you start to think like, well, what do we do now? Like, how do people play a game like World of Warcraft or even something even crazier like EVE Online or something? You know, people are creating these narratives, but they are much more of a give and take versus a one-way dump of a story. And I think that stuff, again, I think the art influences the life a little bit in terms of how video games are created and what people are afforded and also just what players are expected to just go along with. You know, just as Picard is like, okay, yeah, if you're going to go in here, the social contract is that you put on your stupid costume. Like, you don't have to, but that's just kind of the social contract where it's like, in some video games, the social contract is just like, all right, I'm going to have to assume that all of this is fine, that I'm going to overlook little things around like how silly it is to be, you know, actually being a wizard in this, you know, in this context or in this game. I'm going to have to ignore little flaws like every single door opens both ways, like they have double hinges. Like there's just a lot of assumptions that you are expected to make and you willingly make because you are give and take in that narrative versus just getting it fed to you.
That's definitely true. And I think there's also something to say for, I mean, it sounds weird, but like having a captain do it, right? Like I went to Gen Con and I've done a couple of LARPs and I'm not the type of person that would be like, yeah, let's go LARPing or whatever, you know? But it really does make a big difference if you've got people there who lead by example. And you see that with Picard doing his dress up, you know, and everyone is buying into it. And it's honestly, as a viewer of watching anyone on the holodeck, it's inherently entertaining to watch them so joyfully jump into the fiction of the world that they're in. Cause it's the same thing that I'm doing just by watching Star Trek, and I'm doing tenfold when I'm playing a video game.
Yeah. Well, and I also think that regardless of how you feel about Janet Murray's book, I mean, it's one of those classic, I mean, it just brings me back to our academic days where there are certain authors out there where their book is so valuable, whether you agree with it or not, because if you agree with it, you can then become kind of a disciple of her. If you disagree with it, you can make an entire career kind of critiquing her. It's just such a seminal book, but setting that example and putting it out there where This is a new type of narrative to engage in. There are different expectations. There are different societal expectations. Yeah. And also, like, Star Trek is, like, even more extreme where it embraces the, like, these are the most professional people in the entire galaxy. Yes, like, this is the flagship of the fucking Federation. If these
Captain
people
Jean-Luc
are LARPing,
Picard himself.
Yeah, if he's LARPing, that means it could not be any more socially acceptable.
Yes. Man, you know what? I now feel better about LARPing. I'm going to LARP. I'm going to LARP this weekend. Thanks, Jean-Luc Picard.
Thank you, Captain. Yeah, I mean, it's that, again, it's more utopian in nature, but it says something about the importance of being able to play a game or being able to, you know, embark in this shared narrative experience that I think that at their best, video games aspire to, even if they don't always, you know, get there.
I mean, and it sounds weird, but I think even like Janet Murray's understanding of the way that like politics and narrative, like they're not inseparable when it comes to playing a game, even a game that you might not see as incredibly narratively driven or crafted around a particular narrative,
right,
carries into it. And I mean, it sounds silly, but it's kind of true of what I've seen thus far in holodeck episodes, where they're, you know, they're in the video game, but they're confronting like very real things. Even before this episode, where spoiler alert, Moriarty becomes, you know, conscious and aware, there's a scene in last season where Picard is asked by one of the holograms, like, "Hey, when you leave, am I going to still exist? Are my family and kids gonna, are they going to still exist?"
Right.
That's a pretty fucked up and weird question to have in a video game.
Right.
And Picard, I mean, does not give this look. It's not the most comforting answer, but he's just like, "Yeah, I don't know. Good question." And then he bounces and he wipes the whole memory.
Bye.
And, delete. No, like, clearly they don't. The answer is no, you do not exist. But I mean, I like that you can be confronted by things that you're unaware of, or you bring them with you when you go in, you know? Like, Pulaski being super racist to Data is basically why the whole fucking episode took place.
Right. I mean, I think that is, I mean, that's kind of question now that you've seen a handful of these episodes. What else do you see in modern video games that takes after this? Like, is this more like, do you think that the holodeck is, I always like looking back on it, I guess I'll start with me, like looking back on it, I'm always surprised by how structured people are in the holodeck, where it's like, oh, I'm going to play this episode or this story of Sherlock Holmes. I'm going to play the Hound of Baskerville, where you know how it works. It's not just a living, breathing world that you can make emergent gameplay out of. It's I'm going to create a narrative experience. And so I don't know, like, how has that sat with you so far as you've seen a few of these?
It's funny, because the first thought that I was having on that subject was not that everyone is going into this from a narratively driven perspective, but they're going into it wanting to replay things that they already love. Like, my first thought was, of course, they're just replaying old video games. Like, this is a remake. You know, like, today they announced remastering The Last of Us, and I can't wait to play that game again.
Right. You know?
So it's like, it's already my first thought was like, oh, well, yeah, it makes sense that in the future we would still be recreating experiences that we loved back then, just updated in new versions. And there's comfort to be experiencing something you've already experienced before. It's why I still love to play Bloodborne, despite having been through that game numerous times. But I mean, on the specific subject of the narrative angle, I mean, it's similar to the Call of Duty thing. Like, it doesn't really feel like people are going into the holodeck from a like frivolous fun perspective, at least that I've seen thus far, to take on a very real or specific challenge until this episode, right? Where you have a character like Geordi genuinely mad that Data knew all of the solutions because he was so familiar with Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
Geordi wanted to participate in the actual solving of a mystery. It's a narrative mystery, but he wanted a intellectual challenge, you know?
Yeah.
And when Dr. Pulaski ups it and really tries to test Data and kicks off that episode, it's for the same thing, right? And she mentions, like, look, it's not a challenge if you know all of the answers. Like, you have to test yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, even outside of the fact that they are replaying an existing narrative, like, you do see some intent to use the holodeck for a type of more like engaging form of entertainment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true. It's, And I think, to be fair, they, in later dealings with the holodeck, they get into scenarios where, oh, I just go here because I like the, like, this is kind of the, I just like Paris in the 1960s or whatever, and this, right, and that's where I go when I want to have rest and relaxation.
Yeah, we did see Picard, you know, being all melancholy about a date he missed, so.
Oh my god. I didn't know you had watched that episode yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wish I hadn't, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and that, and they get a little bit more into, oh, this is just people's, it's the way that you would return to Bloodborne, or it's the way that today I still boot up Breath of the Wild every once in a while and just kind of traverse for a while with no set goal. I just want to be in that world a little bit.
I mean, I think one of the reasons the holodeck is such a lasting concept is also that when they go into the holodeck, the way that everyone seems surprised, the way that they're talking about everything seeming so real, like, even though they know that they're walking into Victorian London, everyone is still surprised at the sight that they see.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what they're getting into. And there is that sense of wonder when you go in and you don't know what you're about to encounter.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, a major driving force of why I like playing new video games or weird video games, or especially when I play a video game that I haven't watched any media for and I'm just going in blind. Like when we play Death Stranding, who fucking knows what that game is? And that's what's exciting to me, right?
Right.
And I think one of the reasons Holodeck is so lasting is because that is that ultimate promise of a world so well realized that you can walk into it completely unprepared and have it be that seamless experience, you know?
Right.
Because no matter how many years after Star Trek seasons have come and gone and new ones have started, I still really do think that the holodeck is that sort of digital pinnacle of gaming, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of people still see that as the end goal, right? Is a fidelity so real it's like you're there.
You know?
But it's not just because it looks real. Like, we have, as you said, we have experiences that when you're in it, it feels just as real or impactful. Like, I don't have to actually be shot in order to get it and have a good time playing something like Call of Duty or whatever. But it's that sense of wonder that the holodeck has open, because when you know, when it's off and it's just a blank room, it could be anything, you know?
Yes. Do you think that the visual fidelity that they portrayed the holodeck having is a negative thing for video games? And I mean that in, we're chasing the wrong message. Like, we're chasing fidelity versus a sense of place, and where you could argue that Breath of the Wild made me feel a sense of place and an immersion that no VR game could have ever done, despite the fact that VR is theoretically, quote unquote, more immersive, you know?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's exactly where some of the, I mean, like, I don't, we're not trying to dig up the whole, like, ludology versus neurology, you know, like, conversation that I'm ill-equipped to handle anyway, but some of the criticisms of Janet Murray's work were exactly that, right? That it was focusing too much on narrative and not recognizing that there's an element to play that stands outside of that. And I think you could apply that to the concept of fidelity in the holodeck. Like the question about why aren't there people going in and recreating an animated world like Naruto or something is a legitimate question, right? Because there's no reason you have to... There's not even a reason you have to be in the holodeck as a human being. Like, theoretically, it could create a mass around you that is like a bunch of tentacles that you're controlling, or like, who knows what, maybe there's an episode in the future where people in the holodeck are pretending to be dolphins, like swimming around, but you can really truly experience something completely alien and unhuman in there, but we don't see people doing it, you know?
I mean, that's the promise of the, I don't know if they're narrative driven people or ludic driven people, but we hear that every once in a while where we're going to use VR to promote empathy, whether it's
I hate that so much.
So I mean, where is that these days? Like, because I felt like we heard a lot about that a few years ago, but it's died down. Like, is that still a going concern?
I think it still is absolutely an approach that a lot of people in the, like, serious games or social impact games space or art space around VR still absolutely think. And I don't think you're ever going to really get rid of that. I think it's in the same place that VR is, right? Which is like, there's just not a huge install base. And so we don't see the conversation percolating up. And there are definitely opportunities for sympathizing or empathizing with people in VR space. But that's true now. Like there's not a limit to human empathy, you know? I mean, there, I mean, sociologically, maybe there is in terms of proximity and just two things and whatnot. But like, there's just a lot of biases and things that can go wrong in that, in that, with that framework in mind, you know? Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that probably, that's one of the bigger criticisms of the author of a piece of software programs in, whether conscious or not, their beliefs and biases in the system.
Well, and to that point then, like, what is the computer, right? And that's something that we haven't seen people confront is, the computer was also at some point built by human hands and therefore has all of the baggage of humanity, right? That's something that we deal with and confront in video games all the time, you know, where we're trying to talk about how, like, games are political no matter what. You can't really get out of that, you know? And no matter how many times companies will say, like, we're not political, we're not taking a stance. Like, well, you kind of are because you have to, because that's what your game is.
Right. Yeah, I mean, are you a human that exists in this plane of existence? Okay, therefore you have opinions, and those opinions will inherently be in any work that you create.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see someone find the limits to the computer, you know? Like, what are the limits to what people are creating in there, you know? Like, you can see now, like, people rightly call out, you know, popular media for being, you know, racially biased or having gender biases, even unintentionally, even with writing staff that, you know, have diversity and people of color on it and stuff, because it's just so easy to forget that, right? Like, you need to be cognitively aware of that. Does the computer of the holodeck do that? Like, how many characters are people of color in there? What are they, when someone, and I guess we haven't seen it yet because everyone's going back to fucking 19th century London, but there's never a moment where, at least that I've seen, where it's like a fantasy land or it's truly bonkers out of left field. And it'd be interesting to see where the computer is willing to, like, divide, or is that in the hands of the people who are asking the computer to make a simulation, you know? Like, could I say, I mean, computer, make a world that isn't super sexist.
Yeah.
See what that's like.
I mean, I think you will get to a point where you start to understand how some of the simulations are influenced by their authors, like, especially, like, there's a couple episodes about Geordi and his creations in the holodeck, and it's like, oh, this was clearly influenced by how you wanted this world to be, and the computer then just kind of extrapolated out the most extreme version of that.
You kind of get a glimpse of that as well in the scene where Riker and Worf are fighting, like, they're doing like a training regiment or whatever, and there's a one-off joke where Riker's like, oh, this is what you normally do to exercise, and Worf is like, no, usually it's much more rigorous. But that's too intimate to do with you, right? I mean, that alone, like, look, I know it's a one-off joke, but from the over-analysis perspective that you and I love to do in this podcast anyway, that's leagues of information about who Worf is as a character, because he's someone that has intimate moments. He has moments that he doesn't want to share. We know he's a character who's had very little experience being around other Klingons and is trying to explore what that is. Maybe that's what the holodeck is for him, you know, an opportunity to really role play what it might be like to be fully Klingon culturally and physically, you know. And we aren't even allowed, and his crew members and that his bosses aren't even allowed to see that, because that's a piece of himself that he keeps private, which is super cool, and also something that has people have written extensively about in actual video games, where people use MMOs to role play or be and embody characters that they can't otherwise be, but that they identify with. Either they make their race invisible in the video games, and that can be a freeing and enriching experience, because they live a life maybe where they don't, you know, they're too concerned about being seen as a particular race or gender, or with disabilities, and they can be unburdened of that, or where they can role play and embody that in a community of other like-minded players, you know?
I think that's just a great encapsulation of why I think we will always, the holodeck will always be influencing the medium, because I mean, there it is, right? It's people who want to experience either other things or want to push their own kind of personal boundaries or want a space where they can define those boundaries. There is something inherently controllable about it, even though it has elements of surprise. And so, and that's why the holodeck was such a compelling plot device, where it just lets the writers kind of do whatever they want, but then also reset everything so that nothing too bad happens.
And I think that's a really good point about the holodeck also being the ideal when we think about video games, because at least thus far, it is a self-directed space. Like, you define what those limits are. Right. You can always say, computer, exit program, if you want, you know, or you can say, computer, change the parameters in a way that makes that experience so much more personal. And while we can have really intimate and personal experiences in video games, we basically have to be self-delivered those unless we're developing and designing them ourselves, you know? Yes. And someone has to give those to us, and we don't always get it. And in a multiplayer game, you might find yourself with people that are offensive or hurtful or anxiety-inducing, right? Like, games aren't the safe space today, and certainly not in the way that we imagined them to be a decade ago, you know, in our post-Gamergate world. The holodeck is still that dream where you can have any experience you want, and it's totally safe, unless, of course, there's some fucking horrible flaw in the computer that week, you know, because the writers
unless, of course, the holodeck has created something smarter than the smartest being known to exist, Data, and now it's taken over the ship.
And he's self-aware. Yeah. So maybe avoid those moments, but everything else, man, it's a safe space.
It's a safe space. Yeah, it's a safe space to have your weird, you know, Klingon rituals, but just try not to make it sentient, please. Exactly. Can you imagine the memo that went out after that? Picard had to write to, okay, it's, dear crew, Monday briefing, don't make the holodeck sentient. I know what you nasty guys do in there. Well, stop it.
I love that it was basically an error in verbiage, because he said make something that could beat Data, not make something that can beat Sherlock Holmes. And that simple wording was like, oh, you done fucked up, dude.
Computer programming, though. Like, that's the difference between an open versus closed bracket, and then all of a sudden things go haywire.
Yeah, then you done goofed. People should not be fucking around in the holodeck. Just play a regular video game, people. You do not need the holodeck, all right?
Can you please just play holographic Tetris like the rest of us?
Can you just read Sherlock Holmes, for fuck's sakes?
Oh man, I'm very excited to see you get more holodeck episodes under your belt, because they go some places with it that call into question some of these that explore some of these topics in a way that is impressive for the late 80s, early 90s.
Right. Well, I'm ankle deep in season 2, and I've got 7 seasons, so I will still be watching Star Trek probably 4 years from now.
Good stuff. Well, there's more where that came from.
There's always more Star Trek.
All right, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address,
and experiencepoints.net is our bridge. Come on down, find old episodes, relive them in the holodeck.
Just every once in, like I said, I told George, every once in a while I just enter a room and say, computer, archway, just to make sure. You can never be too safe.
Exactly.
You don't know where you're living. All right. Until next time, everybody, thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Beaming out. Every time.